Happy Monday, everyone. I'm Mackenzie Lambert, your host for Mac and the Movies. Today we have an episode that I'm looking forward to. With February being Black History Month, I want to spotlight one of my favorite actors, the one and only Fred the Hammer Williamson. We'll be looking at five of his movies, Three the Hard Way, Bucktown, Mean Johnny Barrows, Adios Amigo, and Joshua. I previously took a look at Three Tough Guys on Episode 7, which was part 4 of my look at the first volume of the Grindhouse Experience box set. That was one of the few turns with Williamson playing the villain. I'll also have some postamble. There has been some amusing backlash to recent comments made by Jason Reitman regarding the third Ghostbusters movie. Recently on Twitter, Jesse Milestone of Mindless Entertainment asked the question, "What is the point of social media?" I'll offer my response. Oh, and I have quite a bit to say about those troll Captain Marvel reviews that actually aren't reviews. Normally, I give a background on the personality that is the focus of the episode, but I feel I would be doing the man serious injustice. I'd rather let the man speak for himself. I'll have a link to an interview in the description where the Hammer goes into great detail about his film and TV career. Part of this interview I used for the aforementioned episode of Mac and the Movies. Now you can watch the whole thing if you haven't already. Now let's jump into the movies. Three the Hard Way opens with a man named House, who is a prisoner in a remote experiment camp operated by white supremacists. In a desperate attempt, he escapes but is badly wounded. He finds a young couple who takes him to his friend, Jimmy. House meets up with Jimmy and his girlfriend, Wendy. They take him to the hospital. House tells Jimmy that he was a prisoner at the camp and cryptically warns them that all of them are in danger. Jimmy dismisses these ramblings as a man who is delirious from excessive blood loss. Jimmy returns to his recording studio while Wendy stays with House. Jimmy is at the studio when two agents from the camp find the hospital. They kill House and kidnap Wendy. In these desperate times, Jimmy calls upon two of his closest friends, Jagger and Mister. When Jimmy meets up with them, they are quickly attacked by more agents of the experiment camp. They find out that the camp is run by Monroe Feather, the leader of a white supremacist militia, and is assisted by Dr. Fortero. The sinister duo have collaborated on a serum that will not harm white people, but will be fatal to black people. It is up to the trio to stop them from poisoning the water in three major cities. Then they plan an attack on Feather's compound head-on, armed to the teeth to rescue Wendy. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. It was basically a street-level superhero movie. The wealthy record producer, the charming playboy, and the disciplined martial artist. These three battling a Bond villain caliber nemesis in Feather with an army of loyalists and a henchman in Dr. Fortero. For all the acclaim that audiences gave Black Panther and even Blade, I'll say that Three the Hard Way was one of the first to give the black community a comic book hero cinema offering. White supremacists are some of the best bad guys. Much like Nazis or robots or zombies, you can just dispose of them in horrific means and you can kill as many of them as you want and nobody blinks an eye. In the final confrontation at Feather's compound, his army is wiped out by the dozens with some overpowering weaponry. In an attempted ambush, one of them is thrown under the wheels of a Chicago transit train. We don't see the gory details, but we hear the chilling scream as he's torn apart. The movie itself has been parodied and paid homage to in the latter films. 2002's Undercover Brother deals with a vigilante, played by Eddie Griffin, stopping Mr. Feathers, played by Chris Kattan, from killing the black population of the U.S. with an ingested toxin. 2009's Black Dynamite involves a similar conspiracy, but with toxins in malt liquor instead of the water supply. Director Gordon Parks had previous experience with the classic Superfly. Yet, with Superfly, you have a cocaine dealer as the protagonist, which, in hindsight, may not have been the best option. Yet, I've seen Latino youth idolize Tony Montana, and Italians make heroes of the Corleone family. With Three the Hard Way, you have three positive representations for black audiences. Script co-writers Eric Bercovici and Gerald L. Ludwig brought their experience with television to this film. Between the two of them, they have over 70 writing credits under their belts. MacGyver, Murder, She Wrote, Hawaii Five-0, Mission Impossible, I Spy, and Man from U.N.C.L.E. are just a few. I've seen Jim Brown previously to watching Three the Hard Way, notably in The Dirty Dozen and Mars Attacks in supporting roles. It was cool to see him in a leading role as Jimmy. He gives a sense of authority and confidence. He's well-mannered and professional, but he can let his temper get the best of him sometimes. Fred the Hammer Williamson plays Jagger. He's the smooth operator oozing with charisma. He had around 9 or 10 film credits by this time, both as a supporting role and in the lead. With Three the Hard Way, he found his footing and what roles fit with his persona. Jim Kelly was riding high off of his performance in the Bruce Lee classic Enter the Dragon, and his own solo outing, Black Bill Jones. One would think his preference for hand-to-hand combat instead of guns would make him an easy target, but he has some impressive stealth close-quarters combat skills. His scene alongside David Chow in the role of Link made for an interesting duo of martial artists that would have been a no-brainer for a movie. Jay Robinson as Mr. Feather and Richard Angarola as Dr. Fortuero are an amusing pair of villains. Mr. Feather is a bit of a dandy, while I can't take Fortuero seriously with his Emo Phillips haircut. These villains are difficult to take seriously, which makes the stakes seem even lower. Had there been more serious actors a la John Saxon or Martin Landau or Robert Vaughn, the tone of the film would have been much more fitting. Sheila Fraser as Wendy doesn't do much, serving as the damsel to be rescued. Fraser made a long career for herself in television. Credits include Starsky and Hutch, The Love Boat, Dallas, and Magnum P.I. Alex Rocco has a small role as Detective Danisco, appearing only in two scenes. The man worked right up to his death in 2015. He has a ton of credits, but he's likely best known for playing Mo Green in The Godfather. Three the Hard Way is well worth watching. You have a trio of great actors with personalities that complement each other. These characters served as role models to a community in need of positive representation in film. This film allowed for Williamson to continue to work on projects of others as well as make his own. You can find the full movie on YouTube. In Bucktown, Duke Johnson returns home to bury his mother. He is unable to leave due to a 60-day period for the brother's estate to be processed. Not long after his arrival, the locals ask him to reopen his brother's bar. Reluctantly, he does so along with his friend Aretha. Unfortunately, the local police try to strong-arm Duke and Aretha for money. They refuse and are threatened. Knowing he's outnumbered, Duke calls in the help of Roy. Roy brings some of his associates with him. Duke, Roy, and others take out the police. While the city seems to calm down, Roy is making moves to take over Bucktown for himself. Roy becomes as corrupt as the police before him. Now Duke must take down Roy's growing empire before it's too late. Bucktown comes across as black cinema's answer to the Joe Don Baker classic Walking Tall. Both deal with an Everman fighting corruption plaguing his town. Both Buford Pusser and Duke have to deal with both the police and the criminal element. What struck me with this film was some of the talent that appeared in this film. Some of these names would go on to success in mainstream and exploitation films. A young Carl Weathers plays one of the associates to Roy. There's also Tony King, who made a number of appearances in Italian films. Distributor American International Pictures were impressed with the success of director Arthur Marx. They would produce his next films, including Fred A. Foster with Pam Grier and J.D.'s Revenge with Louis Gossett Jr. Writer Bob Ellis was primarily a TV writer, both before and after Bucktown. Steve Allen, Dean Martin, Dom DeLuise, Bing Crosby, Julie Andrews, and Mary Tyler Moore were some of the host programs he wrote for. All the more impressive considering they were pretty much variety programs and not narrative-structured programs. Fred Williamson plays on the cocky, arrogant attitude with this film. He's much more down-to-earth. He takes the situation presented in the film seriously, which helps make this film stand out among the rest. Cinema icon Pam Grier also tones down her attitude compared to her roles in Coffee and Foxy Brown. She can handle herself, but she picks her battles. She's not afraid to get involved when this occasion arises. She was big in the 70s, but enjoyed a 90s revival with Original Gangstas, Escape from L.A., Jackie Brown, Mars Attacks, and Jawbreaker. Thalmas Rasulala plays Roy, the leader of the group Duke brings in. The band had a career that started in 1954 and ended in 1992. Not too shabby. We'll see Rasulala again in this episode, but in a much different performance. Tony King and Carl Weathers play two associates of Roy. Weathers, we all know from the Rocky movies and Predator. He directed a lot of television as well. King would appear in Italian cult classics like A Cannibal Apocalypse and The Atlantis Interceptors. Bucktown is a straightforward film. Williamson and Grier offer fine performances. It was cool to see Tony King and Carl Weathers early in their careers. This one will be tougher to find. Physical copies are pricey due to rarity, and the streaming service I watched it on removed it. If you can find it, it's worth watching. Johnny Barrows opens up with Johnny in a minefield training exercise. After a scare involving a live mine, he strikes his commanding officer. This leads to Barrows being dishonorably discharged and sent back home. Shortly after he arrives back, he is attacked and mugged. Police officers arrive, mistaking him for a drunk, and haul him to the station. Thankfully, the police chief recognizes Barrows from his high school football days. From this circumstance, Barrows is free to go, but he ends up on the street homeless and hungry. He ends up in the restaurant of local mobster Mario Racone. Racone gives Barrows a free meal and offers him a job. Pride prevents Barrows from taking odd jobs from the mob. Barrows ends up working at a gas station, but mostly cleaning toilets and getting ripped off by the manager. All the while, tensions between the crime families are growing. The Racone family prides themselves as legitimate business owners. The rival family, the Da Vincis, want to smuggle drugs to sell the kids in the minority communities. During a truce meeting, the Da Vincis shoot down the heads of the Racones. Mario is badly wounded but alive. Mario calls upon Barrows and begs for him to take the fight to the Da Vincis, both out of vengeance for the murder of Mario's father and because of the harm the drugs will bring to the city. Barrows agrees, and he begins to take down the Da Vinci brothers before aiming his sights at the Don. Mean Johnny Barrows marked the directorial debut of Fred Williamson, pulling double duty as both in front of the camera and behind the camera. He tells a very simple story of a man outcast by the military and finds himself in the middle of a possible mob war.
Given the preliminary layout, one might have suspected Williamson was going to take a Yojimbo approach to this movie, but he ends up siding with a mob family that is the lesser of two evils. Williamson's involvement with past productions allowed for him to bring in talents on this film as well as for future projects. Interesting enough, this was not the first time we see Williamson play the role of Johnny Barrows. The character of Johnny Barrows appeared on the November 4th, 1974 episode of The Rookies, which would later have a spin-off show in SWAT. You might not remember the name of the show, but you'll likely know the theme song. There was also the 2003 film with Samuel L. Jackson and LL Cool J. I haven't seen the episode myself, but it would be interesting to see how this episode relates to the events of the film. The writers for the film were Jolivet Kato and Charles Walker. For Kato, Mean Johnny Barrows was his only credit as a writer. He also only had three acting credits, all of them minor. Walker wrote only for Mean Johnny Barrows and the first two episodes for the TV show In a Child's Name. His resume was primarily as a TV actor, with around 140 credits to his name. As an actor, Fred Williamson plays the Johnny Barrows character with a code. He wants to be legit, he doesn't want blood on his hands for doing the mob's dirty work. Eventually, he has no choice. He really sells the internal conflict in having to make such a choice. During one fight, he uses some eagle claw kung fu that we would later see in the 1990 Bronx Warriors. Jenny Sherman plays the femme fatale Nancy. She plays a big part in some of the plot twists, even a suspenseful ending that the audience doesn't anticipate. In this film, Williamson brings some serious star power. Stuart Whitman, an Oscar nominee, Ryan McDowell of Planet of the Apes fame, R.G. Armstrong. Williamson knew he could trust these guys to put in good performances. His MASH co-star, I'm referring to the Robert Altman movie and not the TV show, Elliot Gould, makes a comedic cameo appearance as a homeless man named a professor. He's the one character who brings levity to the film. In minor roles, you have the trio of James Brown, and I'm not referring to the singer, Robert Phillips, and Mike Henry. These three will reappear on this episode later. Brown and Henry are fine in their brief appearances, but it was Phillips who stood out to me. I was kind of wondering where the heck I saw him, and it turns out that I recognize him from one of my favorite MST3K episodes, Mitchell.
Mittens? An action film called Mittens?
Joe Don Baker is Mittens. He's a cop.
Mithril. Oh, wait, it's Mitchell.
Oh, the Martha Mitchell story.
Joe Don Baker is Martha Mitchell.
Yes.
Mean Johnny Barrows showed how much Williamson grew as a filmmaker and as an actor. It also showed he was respected by his peers to land such noted talent. The film is an interesting study in how low a man must fall before he takes on tasks that would go against his moral character. This is one that is easy to find on streaming services and YouTube. Adios Amigo consists of a series of vignettes featuring Big Ben and Sam Spade. Sam is a bit of a troublemaker, all with Ben being in the area at the same time and receiving the brunt of the backlash. Illustrations serve as a bumper between the segments. These skits range from Sam robbing people with Ben taking the blame, Ben getting mixed up in fisticuffs while Sam runs off with the gambling winnings, Sam meets up with a card shark and his beautiful assistants. One segment borrows elements from both The Magnificent Seven and They Call Me Trinity. Ben is forced into a quick draw competition by Sam against a knife thrower. Ben outdraws the knife man, shooting off his pants, revealing pink undies. The origins of this film go back to Blazing Saddles, which came out the previous year. Originally, Richard Pryor was set to play the role of Sheriff Bart, in addition to collaborating on the screenplay. Yet, he would be replaced by Cleavon Little. Williamson himself expressed disappointment with the final version of Blazing Saddles, thinking it went too overboard with the silliness. Williamson had the idea of doing a Western comedy and keeping it as realistic as possible. Also, he wanted Pryor to work without the restraints that would be imposed on him by a major studio. Adios Amigo was filmed in less than 10 days with a bare-bones script that would allow Pryor to improvise. Both Williamson and Pryor expressed disappointment with their own effort. Quoted in Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him by David and Joe Henry, Williamson had to say, "I wanted to give him an idea, a concept, and then just turn the light on him and let him do whatever he wanted. You know what they say about comedians, that you can just open the refrigerator door and the light comes on. The jokes roll on out." Well, Richard's light didn't come on. In an interview for the September 1976 issue of Ebony, Pryor stated, "Tell him I apologize. Tell them I needed some money. Tell them I promise not to do it again." Despite their apprehension, Gene Siskel praised the film for the performances of both Pryor and Williamson. I would agree with that assessment. The film feels like Monty Python's The Meaning of Life or the Kentucky Fried Movie. Only the sketches feature the same two characters. They're enjoyable to watch, and the film is a relaxed, modestly paced viewing. Technically, it has some issues. The cinematography by Tony Palmieri has some problems. One scene features a tight close-up of Williamson, but the woman talking to him is out of frame. Another instance is the fight sequence only focusing on Pryor while Williamson is battling the pugilist. One would think the camera would show Williamson fighting just for a comedic shot. The music by Blue Infernal Machine gets repetitive. After every segment, you hear the Adios Amigo theme. Even more egregious is the casting of the ink spots for a brief scene, and they don't sing.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
How could you have the ink spots in your film and not take advantage of their vocal talents? They're a pre-doo-wop group that enjoyed a revival in the 2000s thanks to video game series like Fallout, Bioshock, and Mafia. Pryor and Williamson work well together. They have great chemistry. The scenes they share will be enough to keep the viewer watching. James Brown, again, not the singer, Robert Phillips, and Mike Henry return from Mean Johnny Barrows. Thomas Rasuala plays Noah, who comes off as something out of a minstrel show. Overall, Adios Amigo is a simple, basic Western comedy. There are some good laughs from Williamson and Pryor. It is very easy to find on YouTube and other streaming services. Joshua opens with an old black woman feeding chickens with the help of a young woman. An older man named Sam arrives with the mail. He gives a present to the younger woman, who turns out to be his wife. He also has news for the old woman. Her son Joshua is returning from service with the Civil War ending. Shortly after, a group of men show up asking for food. The old woman beckons them to come in and she'll make dinner for them. During the dinner, tensions quickly arise when the men take Sam's wife. Sam is badly wounded while resisting, and the old woman is shot. The group escape with Sam's wife in their custody. Within hours, Joshua arrives and is greeted by Sam. Sam updates Joshua about the abduction and the death of his mother. Soon, a lawman posse returns. They lost track of the kidnappers. Joshua takes it upon himself to pursue them and bring Sam's wife back. Joshua catches up with the group and gradually picks them off one by one. It comes down to the leader of the group, Jed, and Joshua. Sam's wife is caught in the middle. Joshua was directed by Larry Spengler, who collaborated with Williamson on previous projects. Williamson wrote the screenplay. He used this opportunity to play a character akin to Clint Eastwood in the Sergio Leone trilogy. Joshua is a man of few words, but has unbreakable resolve. That charisma that Hammer carried films like Three the Hard Way and Mean Johnny Barrows is notably absent. Joshua is vulnerable, taking his shots, and gives them back almost as hard. The film has a commentary on the buying and selling of human beings, in a subtle manner, actually, through the character of Sam's wife. We find out she's a mail-order bride, imported from a foreign country to be the spouse of a man she's never met. She's kidnapped and raped by Jed, and goes through Stockholm Syndrome, falling for her captor. When Joshua tries to rescue her, she refuses and stays with Jed, through to the very end. She seems to have never known freedom. She was just groomed to be someone's property. Much like with Mr. Feather and Dr. Fortuero in Three the Hard Way, Jed and his gang are presented as reprehensible men. They are the worst of the worst. One of Jed's men, Weasel, brags about raping his adolescent sister. It is very easy to hate these guys, and all the more of a joy when Joshua takes them out. The music by Michael Irwin is too much synth for a Western. He tries to use a Morricone-esque whistling motif. It's droning and without a memorable theme or melody. The cast does the best with the slow burn material by Williamson. Cal Bartlett as Jed, Brenda Venus as Sam's wife, and Ralph Willingham as Weasel are fine in their parts. Isela Vega steals the movie as the Mexican girl who's handy with a firearm. Joshua is a slow-paced film, too slow for some compared to the likes of Three the Hard Way or Mean Johnny Barrows. This one is for the hardcore fans of Williamson. Those of a casual nature may not get as much mileage out of this one. And that finishes this look at select films of Fred the Hammer Williamson. Out of these five, Three the Hard Way and Mean Johnny Barrows are the must-sees, with Adios Amigo and Bucktown kind of being the ones that you can save for a rainy day. And with so many films left to look at in his filmography, you can definitely expect for him to return in a later episode in the future. With the movies out of the way, let's get into some post-amble. In the month or so since Jason Reitman, son of Ghostbusters director Ivan Reitman, announced the third Ghostbusters movie, the staunch defenders of the 2016 remake have been going out of their way to be offended by anything. They whined about how this was to appease misogynists and bigots, ignoring or denying the fact that their film was a box office bomb. I'll have more to say about the box office later. In the past week, Jason Reitman said that his film was going to hand the movies back to the fans. I personally interpreted this as his film was made for the fans of the original films. Yet, people still find a way to be offended by this because what else are they going to do all day? They use the quotes as further example of catering to those evil, misogynist, bigoted Ghostbusters fans. This shows that these idiots don't understand how the movie industry works. Sony tried to make the movie they wanted, the one they clamored for online. They made a movie that was not to entertain but to politically proselytize to the ideology. You're a choir that demanded to be preached to. And your movie failed, costing Sony Studios anywhere between $50 to $75 million, although I've heard John Campia say that it may go as far as even $100 million. Yet you stunads who do not know how box office works try to use the 2016 remake box office as evidence of success, for some reason. Math isn't even my strongest subject, and I know how this works. The budget was $144 million. According to Paul Feig in a Vulture interview, he said that the breaking even point was $300 million and the success point was half a billion. The worldwide box office gross was less than $230 million. Already we can say the film failed according to Feig's criteria. Now we have to consider that half of the money goes to the movie theaters and the other half goes to the distributor. That only leaves $115 million going back to the studio. That is around $30 million less than the budget. The movie was an absolute box office bomb. Deal with it. I love it when people try to debate me on Ghostbusters 2016 numbers. I'm just sitting here like,
your arms are just too short to box with God.
Jesse Milestone of Mindless Entertainment recently tweeted a question, "What is the point of social media?" Allow me to offer my stance. Social media has its problems, without a doubt. It allows for some nasty people to amplify their ideas, and for all those who agree and disagree to hear. It also brings depression to many from what I guess has been called social media envy. This is where one sees people posting about successes in life, whether it's jobs, romance, extravagant purchases. The people who see these posts are left with an impression that their lives are meaningless or far less exciting because they are not in a position to partake in such pleasures or privileges themselves. I can absolutely relate to this. However, social media has allowed me to connect with people. I've reconnected with old friends who live in other parts of the world. I can communicate with some of my favorite personalities. 20 years ago, I would never have imagined that I could have a direct line of communication with the likes of Bill Plimpton, Emo Phillips, Joe Bob Briggs, Dardando Sacchetti, The Iron Sheik, Jerry Lynn, and many more. And it has helped me connect with total strangers that share the same interests and passions as I do. Ron Real, Scored to Death, Leanna Kersner, Glenn Criddle, and many more. For all the bad one can pin against social media, there is too much good to overlook. Last but not least, I want to talk about how movie websites and critics have no clue how Rotten Tomatoes works. This is all about the numerous articles about trolls that are giving Captain Marvel negative reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, despite the film not even being out yet. Hollywood Reporter, Slash Film, Digital Spy, Screen Rant, MovieWeb, would all of you just please shut the hell up? People are not leaving reviews. The movie is not even out yet, and Rotten Tomatoes doesn't allow for premature audience reviews. The impression I'm getting from these bloggers is that they wouldn't know a movie review if it was right in front of their faces. At this point, the only thing people can do is either show interest or non-interest in seeing the film. When I checked of this recording, the anticipation was at 44%, but I think it's actually gone way down to like 37, I believe. Add to that the plummeting opening box office speculation, which started at $180 million, but is now down to, I believe, anywhere from $80 million to $120 million. Then you already have Captain Marvel merchandise on the clearance rack before the film even releases. All of these articles just reek of a collusion between media outlets to control a narrative. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but this is fake news.
I haven't got time for this Mickey Mouse bullshit!
And that finishes this episode of Mac in the Movies. Thanks for listening. Next time, we'll be taking a look at some of the most horrifying, disgusting, depraved movies ever made. I'll be subjecting myself to a selection of video nasties. What is a video nasty? Well, you can either do some pre-episode research or wait until Monday, March 11th. If you want to stay on top of content for this channel, consider following me on the format of your choice: Podomatic, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Occasionally, I post snippets of the podcast on YouTube, which, I really need to start doing those more often. You can find me on social media, Facebook and Twitter. If you have any questions or requests, you can reach out to me via Gmail. If you want to help this program grow, consider a one-time donation through PayPal. All of this information is in the description for the episode. Until next time, this is Mackenzie Lambert with Mac in the Movies. Take care, folks.